It seems so far back in history until they find some decrepit old Nazi war criminal still living under a rock and put him on trial. Then you remember that it's still living memory for some people. Hell, Vietnam is too far back in the history books for most young people, and I remember it as if it were yesterday. His words made her brain tingle. She remembered Garrett Creel's words as he carved the roast at the dinner table and discussed the murder with his son. It sounds like something a Nazi would do, except she came across the ocean to get away from those bastards. As they kept chatting, she opened her laptop and searched Google for Nazi war criminal, Vermont. She clicked through the results as they moved the conversation off Sonia Galipo's life to her search through the Idlewild records. She stayed off the topic of ghosts, and on to more personal topics. He was telling her about his long-delayed visit to the doctor for a checkup and how much he hated peeing in a cup when she stopped him. "Daddy?" She stared at her laptop screen, a pulse pounding in her throat. "Daddy." This was how well her father knew her, how many years he'd lived as a journalist. He instantly knew to be excited.
"What, Fee? What is it?"
"You mentioned Nazi war criminals," she said. "Well, I looked it up, and we had one here, in Vermont." She heard a rustle and a click, as he likely picked up his old telephone with its extra-long cord and hurried over to his own computer.
"We did? I've never heard of it."
Fiona scrolled through the article she had up on her screen. In 1973, a Nazi war criminal was arrested in Burlington, acquitted after a trial because the identity couldn't be established beyond a reasonable doubt.
"Is that so? What happened to him?"
Fiona took a breath. There was going to be a possible second trial in Germany, but before it could happen, she died of a heart attack in her own home. Malcolm's voice was a surprised shout.
"She?"
"Yes," Fiona said, clicking on the photo that accompanied the article. A woman stared back at her, a wide forehead, thick hair tied neatly back, a straight nose, thin lips, and a round face. The eyes were perfectly level, well-shaped, the pupils dark, the gaze calm and unexpressive. She was coming down the steps of a courthouse, her body already partially turned away from the camera, as if she was already walking away. "Rose Albert," the photo caption read. "Accused of being concentration camp guard, Rosa Berlitz, leaving court after acquittal this morning." "It was a woman," she said to her father. "She was accused of being a guard at Ravensbrück. And she walked free." Chapter 27. Katie. Barrons, Vermont, December 1950. They thought, at first, that maybe Sonia's dreams had come true, that her relatives had kept her, opened their arms and their home to her, that even now she was sitting on her own bed in her own bedroom, scared and excited and planning to go to school. But by Monday, the rumors were that she'd run away, and that was something very different. Sonia would never, ever run away. The girls knew that. She'd done enough running, enough journeying to last a lifetime. All Sonia wanted was safety, a place to be, even if that place was Idlewild, with the misfits and the ghosts. Katie sat in English class on Monday afternoon, her pulse pounding quietly in her wrists, her temples. Where was Sonia? Her mind spun the possibilities. A broken-down bus. A case of strep throat that hadn't yet been communicated to the headmistress. A misplaced sign that put her on the bus to the wrong destination. She was only 24 hours late. It could have been nothing. But her gut told her it wasn't nothing. She glanced out the window to see a strange car come up the driveway to the main building, slowing and parking by the front portico. The classroom was on the third floor, and from this angle she looked down on the car, on its black and white stripes, on the tops of the heads of the two men who got out, putting on their navy blue policemen's caps. No, she thought,
They're not here for Sonia. She wanted to scream. That night, the teachers told the girls to stay in their rooms, no exceptions. They went from door to door in the dorm with lists in their hands, taking attendance of each girl. We stood every day in the Appleplatz, Sonia had said. It was supposed to be a roll call, but it wasn't. They listened to Mrs. Peabody's steps moving up and down the corridor, the sharp crack of her irritated voice. A girl had run away only last year, and the teachers were angry. Cece looked out the window and watched flashlights in the distance as the adults searched the woods for Sonia. Eventually, Cece climbed the ladder into Roberta's bunk and fell asleep, the two girls curled together in their nightgowns, their faces drawn and pale. Katie stayed awake, watching the lights, watching the woods. The next day there was still no sign of her, and again the next. A rumor went around that Sonia's suitcase had been found, that Mrs. Patton had it in her office. Katie thought about Sonia packing her suitcase, carefully folding her few stockings, her notebook, the copy of Blackie's Girl's Annual that Roberta had returned to her. She ground her teeth in helpless anger. The weather grew bitter cold, though no snow fell yet. The sky was dark in the morning when the girls were roused for morning classes, and it was dark again when they finished supper and left the dining hall, stumbling over the common to their dorm. Roberta went to morning practice in the dark, the girls in their navy uniforms, ink blots against the field in the pre-dawn stillness, playing in silence with barely a shout. Katie watched Roberta dress, her skin as pale and gray as she knew her own was, her eyes haunted, her mouth drawn tight. Darkness and silence. Those were the two things that dominated the days after Sonia disappeared. Darkness and silence. Waking and sleeping. Then darkness and silence again. After that first night, flashlights were not seen in the woods again, though the girls were kept under strict curfew after supper, roll call taken by the teachers as they sat in their rooms. Cece was the one who went to Mrs. Patton's office, pleading for the search to continue. "She's not run away," she said to the headmistress, the woman no girl dared approach. "She can't have run away. She's hurt. Please, we have to help her." It was hopeless. She'd begged Katie to come with her, but Katie had refused, embalmed in the dark and the stillness, her body numb, her brain hushed, watching everything as if it were a world away, watching the other Idlewild girls lose the fearful looks on their faces and begin to chatter again. "She just ran away, that's all," Susan Brady said. Susan was riding high on her importance as the dorm monitor, helping the teachers with roll call every night. She heard things the other girls didn't, things the students weren't supposed to hear. "That's what the police say. They say she must have found a boy. She wouldn't need her suitcase if he bought her all new things, would she? That's what I think. She was quiet, secretive." She shrugged. "Who knows?" The teachers lost their tense, watchful postures, their anger replaced with the usual everyday irritation again. "Ladies, ladies! Sportsmanship!" 3 days. That was all it had taken. 3 days. 4, 5, 6. "She's hurt." The girls didn't speak of it. The girls barely spoke at all. "I'm failing her," Katie thought. The words like constant echoes buried deep in her brain. "She needs me, and I'm failing her." It was Cece who had had the courage to go to the headmistress's office, not Katie. It was Roberta who had left early for field hockey practice to search the woods on her own. Katie was powerless as she'd been in the moment Thomas had thrown her down in the playground and yanked her skirt, his breath in her face. As powerless as she'd been the day she'd gotten out of her parents' car and looked up at the portico of Idlewild. All her bravery, all her bluster, was a fake. At the end of it all, when it came down to what mattered, Katie was a girl and nothing more. Each floor of the dorm had a shared bathroom at the end of the hall, Aside from regular washing, the girls were allowed a bath once per week, the days allotted on a schedule. On Cece's night, 7 days after Sonia hadn't come home, Katie was in their room, lying on her bunk and staring at the slats of the bunk above her, enduring the endless stretch of time between supper and curfew when she heard screaming from down the hall. She flew out of bed and fought her way to the bathroom, pushing aside the other girls who crowded the door in curiosity. They gave way easily when they saw who she was. She didn't even have to kick anyone in the shins. She got to the bathroom to find Cece still in the bathtub, hunched over her knees, her arms crossed over her ample chest, her hair hanging wet and plastered to her face, her lips blue, her eyes vacant. She was shaking. Katie whirled to the other girls. "Get out!" she snapped at them, and when they receded back, she slammed the door. Then she turned to Cece. "What happened?" Cece looked up at her, her big eyes pools of terror. Her teeth chattered. For the first time in a week, everything was so clear in that moment. The puddles of water on the cold tiled floor. The lip of the big old bathtub that dated back to the day Idlewild was first built. The smell of school-issued soap and shampoo, mixed with a sickly smell of lavender that came from the bath soap Mary Van Wharton's older sister gave her, which she used religiously. The intestinal coils of the hot radiator against the wall, the grid of the drain against the floor, its wrought iron stark and black against the white tiles. The air was chilled, as if a draft had leaked into the room, and Katie felt as if someone had slapped her awake. "What happened?" she asked Cece again. Cece answered, but Katie was so awake in that moment she already knew what Cece would say. "She was here." "Mary?" Katie demanded. "In this room?" Cece looked away, her teeth still chattering. "I was rinsing my hair. I went under the water. I saw a shape." She shuddered, so hard it looked like she'd been shoved with a cattle prod. "Something held me down." Katie looked down at her. There was not a whisper of disbelief in her blood, not a twinge of doubt. Cece's mother had tried to drown her, had held her down. It was the reason Cece was here. It was exactly what Mary Hand would prey on. Katie jerked up her sleeve, bent over the bathtub, and pulled the plug from the drain. As the water gurgled, the door behind them opened with a quiet click. The toilets locked, but the bath did not, not at Idlewild. And Katie turned to shout at the intruder until she saw it was Roberta. Roberta closed the door quietly behind her and looked from one girl to the other, instant understanding on her face. She grabbed a bath towel and held it out to Cece, who snatched it and wrapped it around herself. "Are you all right?" Roberta asked. Cece nodded, staring at the floor. Then tears began streaming down her cheeks, and her shoulders shook with a sob. "Let's get her out of here," Katie said. But Roberta was staring at the mirror. "Look," she said. The fog on the bathroom mirror was drying, but near the top of the mirror, the letters were still visible, written by something scratchy. "Good night, girl." Cece made a choked sound in her throat, and Katie grabbed the girl's robe and threw it over her shoulders. But it was Roberta who leaned over the sink, raised her arm, and scrubbed the words away with a vicious jerk, her jaw set, her fist scrubbing so hard on the mirror it made a screeching sound. The curious girls in the hall had lost interest and dispersed, and the three girls went back to their room in hushed silence, Roberta's arm over Cece's shoulders. Still, Cece was sobbing when they closed the door behind them. The robe dropped unheeded as she clutched the too small towel to her, her shoulders shaking and tears rolling down her face. "She's dead," she said, the words sounding like stones she was trying to dislodge from her throat. "We can say it out loud. She's dead." Roberta and Katie exchanged a glance. Cece rubbed a palm over her wet cheek. "Mary killed her." Bile curled in Katie's stomach. "Not Mary," she said. Someone did, but not Mary. Cece looked up at her, her eyes wide and seared with pain, searching Katie's face. What do we do? There was the helplessness again, creeping down the back of her neck. But this time, Katie fought it. There had to be something. But dead was dead. She knew in her bones that Sonia wasn't alive anymore, not after a week. They couldn't save her. Maybe they never could have. Roberta picked up Cece's robe from the floor and hung it, then walked to Cece's dresser drawer and pulled out a nightgown and a pair of underpants. She held them out to Cece. "Do you know what I don't like?" she said. Her face was pale and sickly, like that of someone who had lost a lot of blood, but her eyes were fire. "I don't like that Mrs. Patton has her suitcase." Katie swallowed. She was angry now, the fire in Roberta's eyes similar. Those were Sonia's things, her books, her notebook, her socks and underwear. They'd all watched her pack them, lovingly, hoping she'd never come back here. It wasn't right that a bunch of adults who hadn't known Sonia and had given up on her got to keep the suitcase and forget about it. Besides, it was possible there was a clue in there. "It must be somewhere in Mrs. Patton's office," she said. "Which is locked," Cece said. She had taken the underpants from Roberta and slid them on beneath her towel. Her face was still blotchy, but now her mouth was set in a grim line. "I'll bet Susan Brady has a key," Roberta said. "To the headmistress's office?" That didn't seem likely to Katie. "There's a skeleton key," Cece said, as Roberta held up the towel and she turned away to put on her nightgown. "I've heard Susan brag about it. It opens everything. She isn't supposed to have it, but she's Mrs. Peabody's pet, and Mrs. Peabody gives her things to do that she doesn't want to do herself, so she has to have a key." Well, well. Things were always so easy when girls and teachers were stupid. "All right, then," Katie said. "Cece, you're still distraught. You need to go see the nurse. Tell Susan that Roberta and I are mad at you and won't take you, and you have no one else." Cece had always pretended to be the stupid one, but Katie wasn't fooled. Cece caught on quickly. "That's no fair," she said, her distress over the bathroom incident fading beneath her outrage. "I want to help. I was lookout for you when you took extra food from the kitchen for Sonia. I'm good." "You are," Katie agreed, meaning it. "But everyone just heard you screaming in the bathroom, so now is the perfect time to get Susan out of her room. So go get her to take you to Miss Hedmeyer. Roberta and I will get the key." "Get it and wait for me," Cece insisted. "I'm coming too." Katie bit her lip, but she couldn't argue. If the roles were reversed, she wouldn't want to sit out. "Be quick, then," she counseled. "Tell Miss Hedmeyer you have cramps, and she'll give you some aspirin and send you back to your room. Susan will be mad, but just act sheepish." Cece shrugged. "Susan thinks I'm stupid anyway." It was infuriating how many people got things wrong about you when you were a teenage girl, but as she had learned to do, Katie took her anger and made it into something else. She had the glimmer of an idea in the back of her mind, an idea bigger than stealing a key from Susan Brady's room and getting Sonia's suitcase from the headmistress's office. Her anger fed it, like wood being fed into a fire. It would take thought and planning and time. Katie had plenty of time. But first, she wanted Sonia's suitcase. "Get your slippers on and get moving," she said to Cece. She pinched Cece's cheeks so their red splotchiness wouldn't fade yet. Cece turned her face to Katie, then to Roberta, who dabbed water on her cheeks from the basin. Katie watched in admiration as Cece closed her eyes for a minute, drooped her shoulders, and let her bottom lip go soft. Then she whirled and ran from the room, slamming the door behind her as if running from an argument. It was almost too easy. Susan Brady led Cece to the nurse, Susan chiding and Cece choking back distressed sobs. Roberta kept watch in the hall while Katie slipped into Susan's room and rifled through her things, looking for the key. She found it in Susan's jewelry box, among the tiny gold earrings and a cheap paste ring. Both girls were back in their room when Cece returned, having swallowed the requisite chalky aspirin and taken a verbal drubbing from Susan. She quickly dressed, and the three of them set out, slipping down the stairs into the common, then to the main hall. The skeleton key let them in just fine, and down the hall to the headmistress's office. Sonia's suitcase was in a closet at the back of the room, alongside Mrs. Patton's winter coat and snow boots and other confiscated items taken from Idlewild girls over the years. Lipsticks, cigarettes, a pearl compact and mirror, a pair of silk stockings, a glossy photograph of Rudolph Valentino. How old was that? Katie wondered. And two beautiful, priceless items, a small flask of alcohol and a stack of magazines. The girls couldn't resist. Katie pocketed the alcohol, Roberta snatched the magazines, and Cece took the suitcase. They dropped the skeleton key in the garden, Roberta edging it beneath the soft, wet earth with the toe of her shoe. Back in their room, they set aside the unexpected loot and went quietly through the suitcase, reverently touching Sonia's things. The case was neatly packed, and Katie knew that no one had opened it since Sonia had packed it at her relative's house. Not one person, not the headmistress, not the police, not anyone, had bothered to look in the missing girl's things. Katie opened Sonia's notebook, leafing through the pages as the other two girls looked on. There was Sonia's handwriting, the portraits she'd drawn of her family and the people she'd seen at Ravensbrook. There were maps and sketches and pages of memories, Sonia's short life put down in her private journal. In the last pages were portraits of her three friends, drawn closely and lovingly. Katie had already known that Sonia was dead, but looking at the notebook, which Sonia, while alive, would never have abandoned to her last breath, she knew. "This is goodbye," Katie thought. "But not farewell. Someone did this, and I won't stand for it. None of us will." The girls closed the suitcase and went to bed. And Katie began to think. Chapter 28. Burlington, Vermont, November 2014. The small building that had once been the bus station in downtown Burlington was long gone. Anyone wishing to catch a bus had to go to the Greyhound station, just out of town at the airport. Fiona stood on the sidewalk on South Winooski Avenue and stared at a Rite Aid that was currently closed down, the sign half dismantled and the windows boarded. Traffic blared by on the street behind her. This was a section of town populated with grocery stores, laundromats, gas stations, and corner stores, with a gentrifying residential area starting farther up the street. It looked very little like it would have looked in 1950, but Fiona still felt a connection, a quiet jolt of energy, knowing she was standing in the place Sonia Gallipo had stood on the last day of her life. She ignored the people walking by, who were giving side looks to the woman staring at a closed-up Rite Aid and turned in a circle. This wasn't just a sentimental visit. Fiona was making a map. Rose Albert. Rosa Berlitz. Had they been one and the same? Was there a way Rose Albert, in her made-up American life, could have crossed paths with Sonia? It had taken only a little digging, cross-referenced with county tax records, to get addresses. The police records said the ticket taker had seen Sonia at the bus station, getting on the bus. Fiona was at ground zero of Sonia's case, the last place she was seen by anyone except the bus driver, who was never interviewed, and her killer. But Sonia had gotten on the bus. That was witnessed, and her suitcase was found on Old Barron's Road, a few hundred feet from Idlewild. Fiona had spent a sleepless night going over it, wishing painfully for Jamie, his clever logic, his head for facts. It wasn't easy, figuring these things out alone. And it wasn't fun, either. But she had come to some conclusions that she thought were the most logical, the most likely. As Sherlock Holmes said, Eliminate the impossible, and what's left must be the truth. If she followed the Rose Albert theory, it wasn't impossible that a woman who lived in Burlington would coincidentally be standing on Old Barron's Road in the middle of nowhere when Sonia Gallipo walked by. But it was unlikely. It was more likely that Rose Albert had come across Sonia in Burlington before she got on the bus. But that didn't turn any of it into fact. The newspaper reports of Rose's trial had stated that Rose Albert worked as a clerk in a travel agency 4 streets away. Perhaps Rose had somehow spotted Sonia from her home, a 15-minute walk from the travel agency, while Sonia and her relatives were out enjoying their weekend. Fiona started walking down South Winooski Avenue toward the home where Sonia had stayed. But half an hour later, she was no further along. The house of Henry and Eleanor Dubois was nowhere near the address where Rose Albert was listed as living. She could not see how Rose and Sonia could have crossed paths in the space of a weekend. It didn't help that there was no way of knowing what activities the Dubois's had done with their great niece. Shopping? Sightseeing? Walking in the park? Eating out? If Sonia had any new-bought items or souvenirs in her suitcase, it would have given a clue as to where she had gone that weekend. But the suitcase had disappeared from Julia Patton's office after Sonia was murdered, never to be seen again. She was walking back toward the site of the former bus station, wishing someone in 1950 had interviewed the goddamned bus driver, when it struck her so forcefully she stopped on the sidewalk to think. The bus ticket. That was the connection. In 1950, you didn't buy a bus ticket online or from a machine at the bus station using a credit card. You bought a bus ticket from a clerk at the station or at a travel agent's. Rose had worked as a clerk for a travel agent, filling out and filing the stacks of paperwork that accompanied travel bookings in the pre-internet age. Sonia's relatives had bought her a round-trip bus ticket to Burlington, but when Sonia had run away to go back to school, she must have changed it. Fiona felt the excitement building in her chest, and she started walking again, nearly jogging back toward her car. It was easy to picture. Sonia at the travel agent's, changing her ticket, while Rose sat at her desk doing paperwork. Had Sonia seen Rose? Had she recognized her? She must have. Rose must have known that Sonia knew who she was, that she could identify her as Rosa Berlitz. She knew what bus Sonia was taking back to Idlewild, and at some point, Rose Albert must have decided that she'd have to do something permanent about Sonia, or her life would fall to pieces. It was speculation. It wasn't concrete. There were a million ways it could have been wrong. It was more far-fetched than the theory of one of Sonia's friends simply caving her head in and dumping her in a well. But if you followed it, it fit. Sonia had been in the same city at the same time as a woman who might have been a guard at Ravensbrook, where Sonia had been a prisoner. She had visited family within blocks of Rose Albert's home and her office. How far apart had they been? Guard and prisoner. 1 mile at most? The two of them in the same place in America, 5 years after the war ended. A coincidence, but a documented one. It fit. Fiona thought back to the picture from the news story. Rose Albert's calm face, her level eyes, her large pupils, her milky skin. The face of Rosa Berlitz, the guard who had put women in the gas chambers, in the ovens. If she had done that, then the death of one teenage girl would have meant nothing, not in the face of survival, not if a secret had to be kept. If it was true, then Sonia Gallipo's murder wasn't random or impulsive. She had been chosen and stalked, though not in the way that Jeanette Harrison had imagined. She had been under a death sentence from the moment she walked into Rose Albert's travel agency, followed until she was away from the city and the crowds, until the bus had driven away and she was alone on a deserted road. Rose Albert hadn't even needed to take the bus alongside her prey. She had already known where her prey was headed. She could have traveled ahead to the bus stop in her car, parked, and waited until the bus pulled up and the girl got off. If you were hunting for someone to murder, Jeanette had said, what better person could you choose? Her head was pounding when she got home, since she'd barely slept and she hadn't eaten. The light was still out in the hallway on her floor. It had burned out nearly 3 weeks ago, and for once she was grateful for the eerie half-light that was usually an alarming security concern. Her thoughts were too heavy, too loud, and she wanted only the darkness of her apartment. He was there. She hadn't expected him, but somehow when she saw him, she wasn't surprised. Jamie, sitting on the floor next to her closed apartment door, his back against the wall, his knees up. Out of uniform, wearing jeans and a t-shirt with a flannel shirt unbuttoned over it and work boots, his hair mussed. He watched her come up the hallway toward him, his expression closed and blank. Fiona stopped in front of his feet and looked down at him in the half-light. "How long have you been here?" she asked softly.
"Not long."
"You have a key." He looked up at her. The fight was gone from him, the outrage, the bluster. He just looked at her.
"It took me 8 months to get that key,"
he said finally. It was true. He had given her his key long before she'd given him hers, and it had been hard for her even then. Her father didn't have a key to her place. No one did, not ever. But at long last, she'd given Jamie one. She'd questioned it. She hadn't trusted it. It had scared her, so much so that she hadn't noticed he'd been careful with it, that he always called or texted her first, that he'd gone slow. She saw that now, so clearly. "Keep it," she said to him, her voice hoarse. He looked away. She should have opened the door now, invited him in if he wasn't going to come in himself. Part of her knew that. But he seemed disinclined to move, as if whatever he had to say was better here in the hallway, with the broken lights and the ugly industrial carpet.
"I came here to explain," he said.
"You don't have to explain."
"I do."
She watched him struggle with this.
"You were right."
He was going to tell her something buried, and she hadn't thought she could handle any more buried things, but she owed him this. "Right about what?"
"Helen Heyer," he said. "I pulled the file."
Her stomach dropped. "What do you mean?"
"They questioned Helen's friends," Jamie said. "The cops working the case. They interviewed her friends about whether she'd ever told them about her relationship with Tim Christopher. What they didn't do was ask Tim's friends."
Fiona was quiet.
"Tim was popular," Jamie continued.
He glanced at her.
"You know that, of course. He had a lot of friends. They could have interviewed them, found out who Tim was seeing. One of them would likely have known who he was dating, whether he was lying about Helen. It's routine. But they didn't. They interviewed Tim with his parents in the room. And then they dropped it."
He shook his head.
"It doesn't prove that Tim tried to kill Helen. The M.O. still doesn't fit, but..."
He trailed off. Fiona knew the rest of it without words. The fact that the cops had backed off from the Christophers meant they'd left part of the investigation undone. If any of his friends had admitted that Tim was seeing Helen, Deb would be alive. Then Jamie made her stomach drop further by saying,
"Dad's name is in the file. He did the interview."
"Tim Christopher was a good man before his life was ruined," Garrett had said. "My God, Jamie."
"When I was a kid, he used to take me for ride-alongs," Jamie said. "It was what made me want to be a cop. He'd take me on patrol, and not much happens in Barrens, you know, so we'd spend most of the time shooting the shit. I thought being a cop was fun, and Dad was chief, so everyone treated him like a boss. What's not to like?"
He rubbed the bridge of his nose, his eyes tired, and Fiona waited.
"One night we got a domestic call," Jamie continued. "A woman said her husband was hitting her. I was with him. I was 10. He put me in the back seat while he and his partner went inside. I don't know what happened in the house. But after 10 minutes, they both came out, and we drove away without a word. I asked my dad what had happened. He told me it didn't matter, everything was fine. because he was good friends with the guy's brother. Then he turned and looked at me in the back seat. "Family comes first, doesn't it, son?" he said. His partner didn't say anything, not a word. And I was 10, and he's my dad, so I just nodded and agreed with him. I'd thought I'd forgotten about that night until I became a cop. Then I remembered it.
"What are you saying?" Fiona asked.
"It's small things, you know," Jamie said, "or so it seems. His golf buddy's speeding ticket gets thrown away. Another buddy's nephew gets off with a warning when he spray paints the school. The mayor's son gets let go when he's caught driving over the limit. Dad was still chief when I started, and everyone accepted it. We fought about it at first, but no one would back me up, and Dad was close to retirement. I started to think I could just wait it out. And after Dad was gone, I could help the force be different. Do things different, like those old days were gone."
Fiona remembered Garrett at the family dinner, how he'd known everything that was going on in the force. "Except it didn't work out that way, did it?" she supplied. Jamie was quiet for a long beat.
"He's so fucking powerful," he said. "And Barron's is so small. I didn't realize how bad it was, how deep it was, until I'd been on the force for years. No one questions the chief, or anything he does, because then you're off the gravy train. Everyone on the force has it easy. Why rock the boat? They tell themselves it's just a slip here and there, never anything serious. No one is getting hurt. You do a favor for someone. They do a favor for you. Just fill out the paperwork and go home." And I woke up one day and realized I'd been on the force for 7 years, and I was starting to think that way too. That toxic, don't give a fuck. I realized I had to get away somehow, get out to save myself.
He looked up at her.
"That was the night I met you."
Fiona stared at him, speechless.
"I knew who you were," he said, "that night. You were right. Of course I knew. But I wanted to talk to you anyway."
"Why?" He shrugged.
"You looked lost, like me. You're Malcolm Sheridan's daughter. You've lived life. You know this place. But you don't quite buy it, don't quite buy anything. You don't buckle under. You're beautiful. And your shirt was sliding off your shoulder."
She dropped to her knees, put her hands on his shoulders. He was warm, tense, his muscles bunched beneath her hands. "Jamie," she said, "Helen Heyer isn't a thrown-away speeding ticket." He looked at her, right into her, in that way Jamie had, as if he knew what she was thinking.
"I know,"
he said roughly, touching his fingertips to the line of her jaw.
"I'm not going to drop it, Fee. I'm going to take it as far as it can go. I'm done."
She leaned in and kissed him. He kissed her back, his hands tangling in her hair. This was so easy. This they knew. She slid forward between his knees and ran her hands down the tops of his thighs, through his jeans, as he opened her mouth slowly, gently. It felt raw and familiar and real, and she knew how this would go. Sex with Jamie was never rushed. He liked to take his time, go slow, as if he was studying her. She realized now that it was because he was never entirely sure that she would be back, because he never quite knew which time would be the last time. And neither did she. She followed the kiss where it led, not caring if any neighbors came down the hallway, not caring that she was hungry and her knees hurt, not caring about Idlewild or dead girls or anything but the way she could read his pulse beneath his skin. He broke this kiss and sighed, his hands still twisted in her hair.
"We're not doing this," he said.
It wasn't a question. She kissed his neck, feeling the scrape of his beard against her mouth. "No," she agreed. "Not right now." He let his head drop back, banging it against the wall.
"Fuck,"
he muttered.
Fiona pressed her cheek against his collarbone. He dropped a hand to the back of her neck. And they stayed like that for a long, long time.
Chapter 29. Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. Fiona woke on the sofa, her throat scratchy and her neck sore. She rolled over, looked at the mess of her apartment in the dark. There were stacks of boxes, papers. On her coffee table were her laptop and a half-eaten box of Ritz crackers. She tapped her laptop to make it wake up so she could see the time in the little display in the corner. It was 6 a.m. She stared at the screen, looking at the topic she'd been reading about when she fell asleep, sometime around 3. Rose Albert. Rose's face stared at her. The picture had been taken on the street by an enterprising photographer sometime after Rose had been arrested and granted bail. She was dignified, wearing an old-fashioned skirt and jacket and a fur stole, out of style in 1973, but giving off an air of class. At the time of the trial, she was only 55, with the clear skin Fiona had seen in the other photographs of her, her mouth a firm line, her eyes so perfectly even and dark, her expression shuttered and cool. The photographer had caught her unawares, and she had put a hand to the fur stole as she walked, nearly clutching it. The few accounts Fiona had found of the trial had described her as wearing a fox fur stole, the same one. The trial itself was not on public record. The transcripts were sealed. It had been a mid-sized local story in its day, worthy of a dedicated reporter and a photographer assigned to take shots from the street once or twice, but it hadn't been front-page news. Looking at the coverage, Fiona could perfectly follow the logic of that news editor in 1973. They had to cover the story for the local angle, because there were people who knew this woman. But hell, no one wanted to read about concentration camps, really. It was too depressing and out of touch. Vietnam was happening. Vietnam was real. A lady in a fur stole who might or might not have been an old Nazi was news, but not big news. Still, the coverage was well-researched and well-written, making Fiona nostalgic for the heyday of reporters who were actually on staff instead of freelance, and stories that didn't have to say, "You won't believe what happened next," in order to survive in the click-or-die internet age. Rose Albert was a spinster living in Burlington, an immigrant from Europe after the war. She claimed to have come from Munich, where she had worked in a factory. She did admit to being a member of the Nazi Party, but she claimed that it was only a survival tactic, because under Hitler's regime, those who did not join were suspect. Yes, she had attended rallies, but only so she wouldn't have been denounced by her neighbors and arrested. No, she had not worked in a concentration camp, and once the war was over, she had come to America to start again, and she had been lucky enough to get the job at the travel agency. Rosa Berlitz, the Ravensbrück guard, was a mystery. She had been recruited from one of the local German villages, a girl with no experience, and had taken to the job at once. She had chased prisoners with the dogs the Nazis had given the guards, who were trained to attack and kill. She had stood by while women were experimented on and sentenced to death, then helped carry out the murders. Who her family and friends were was unknown. What had happened to her after the war, when the Soviets liberated Ravensbrück, was also unknown. Rosa Berlitz had appeared from nowhere, tortured and killed the prisoners of Ravensbrück without flinching, and disappeared again. There was only one known photograph of Rosa, standing in a line of other guards, being inspected by Himmler as he toured the camp. Himmler was a large figure in the picture, wearing his long coat and Nazi insignia, striding across the grounds. The women were in uniform, ranged in 3 neat rows. But Rosa's face was in the back row and slightly out of focus, leaving only 2 dark eyes, a straight nose, a glimpse of white skin. It might have been Rose Albert, and it might not. No other record of Rosa Berlitz was left, nothing that said she had existed at all, except for the memories of the prisoners who had lived under her. 3 survivors had identified Rose Albert as Rosa Berlitz. One had died of cancer the week before the trial began. The other 2 had testified in court.
It seemed there had been too many holes, too much missing information in the trail leading back to Rosa Berlitz, even with the survivor's testimony, and Rose had gone free. When Fiona dug further, she found that the two remaining survivors had died in 1981 and 1987. Rose Albert was acquitted, but later that year she was found dead in her home. The coroner declared the cause of death a heart attack, and she was quietly buried, her death a footnote in the back pages. Fiona peeled herself off the sofa. She felt hideous, as if she'd gone on a bender, though all she'd done was sit in her dark apartment and read. She put coffee on and got in the shower, but that only made her shiver no matter how hot she turned the water tap. She washed quickly and got out again, then dried off. She gulped her coffee and tried not to think of Jamie, of what he was doing right now, of Garrett Creel, of Tim Christopher with a baseball bat coming up the walk behind Helen Heyer. Maybe she was coming down with something. Her head was throbbing and her throat was still sore. She dug in her cupboards and found some ibuprofen, some cold meds, and old Halls. She took the pills and popped the Halls in her mouth, wincing at its waxy old texture and menthol taste. She had no time to be sick, not now, not yet. She needed to settle some things. She put on her coat and boots, pulled a thick wool cap over her still wet hair, and walked out the door after grabbing her keys. The dawn was gray, the wind icy and bitter, which meant only one thing, snow on the way. It was nearly December, and from now until April, Vermont would fight the winter battle as it always did. Old Barron's Road was quiet, though Fiona could see movement on the Idlewild property through the trees. The pause to retrieve Sonia's body was over, and the restoration had started up again. But she didn't go to Idlewild this time. She found the rough, overgrown driveway on the left-hand side of the road instead of the right, and followed it into the overgrown weeds where the drive-in used to be. She remembered walking along Old Barron's Road, talking to Jamie on the phone. It felt like years ago. But he'd reminded her that the old drive-in had still been open in 1994. On the night Deb died, it hadn't been running any movies because November was the off-season, but it was still a hangout for kids who liked to drink in an abandoned lot. The police had interviewed as many of those kids as they could find, but none of them recalled seeing Tim Christopher's car parked at the side of Old Barron's Road, which he must have done in order to dump Deb's body. The drive-in had closed sometime in the late 90s, and like most people, Fiona had assumed that it was an empty lot. Until she'd met Stephen Heyer in Portsmouth, and he'd told her that he'd seen her because he slept here sometimes. The old man who used to run the drive-in lets me use his place. Her car rumbled over the dirt path, brushing the clumps of overgrown weeds. The screen was long gone, as was the popcorn stand. But a sign remained, placed along what was once the driveway where the cars would patiently line up, waiting to pay admission. It was a 4-foot billboard showing a dancing hot dog and a can of soda doing a jitterbug on cartoon legs. "Welcome to our drive-in," the lettering proclaimed. Water had damaged the edge of the billboard, and time had faded its colors, but surprisingly, the vandals and graffiti artists had left it alone, a relic in the abandoned lot. Fiona pulled the car just past the sign to where the open lot was and put the car in park. She was cold, her spine shivering, though she was huddled in her coat with the heat on high. Snow coming, she thought. She looked around. Where the hell does Stephen Heyer sleep in this place? She pulled out her phone, thinking to call someone about something important, but then she stared at the display, bewildered. Her thoughts were moving too fast, spinning out of her hands. I'm not sick. I'm not. She thumbed through her contacts and almost dialed Jamie just to hear the rumble of his voice, but she flipped past his number and dialed Malcolm instead. She got his answering machine. She could picture it, a literal machine, an old tape-recording answering machine that sat in his phone nook, because, of course, her father had a phone nook, next to his 90s-era landline phone. The phone rang, and the machine whirred to life, sending Malcolm's voice down the line, asking her to leave a message, and then a loud beep. Daddy, she said, there's something I have to tell you. She told him about Stephen Heyer, how he'd found her, what he'd told her, about how she'd seen Helen Heyer, who had nearly been beaten to death with a baseball bat by Tim Christopher the year before he'd met Deb. She was still talking when the machine cut her off. She hung up. You'll kill him with this shit, Jamie had said. And then her father's voice, when she was 14 and her mother didn't want the distressing picture he'd taken in Vietnam framed and put on the wall. Do you think they won't see the real world, Jenny? He said. Do you think the real world will never come to them? Fiona touched her cheeks. There were tears there, though they were cold and nearly dry. She wiped them off with her mittened hands and got out of the car. The wind stung her cheeks. She walked across the clearing that had once been the parking area of the drive-in, where everyone would have parked facing the screen. Her boots crunched on the dirt and old gravel. The sky lowered, angry and gray. She walked toward where the screen would have been, trying to see past the rise there. She couldn't see anyone or any cars, but she noticed that the abandoned lot was scrupulously clean, free of litter or garbage, which didn't compute with a place teenagers had been using for decades. At the other end of the gravel, she saw it, an old house set back, nearly hidden by trees. A trailer parked farther back in the shadows. A pickup truck on the drive. Hell, she thought, someone really does live here.
Help you?
A voice said. She turned to see a man of her father's age, though heavily muscled, his head shaved in a military crew cut. He wore a thick parka, boots, and old army pants, but it was the rifle slung casually across his forearms that Fiona stared at, cradled in his grip a little like a baby. I'm looking for Stephen Heyer, she said. The man shook his head.
He's not here.
Fiona blinked. Her eyelids were cold in the wind. He told me he sleeps here sometimes.
He does, the man said, but not today.
Fiona felt her shoulders slump. This had been her only idea. She didn't have another. But I need to talk to him. The man looked at her curiously and did not move the gun from his arms.
Sorry, he said. And I hate to point it out, but you're trespassing.
I didn't know this was private property, Fiona said through her fog. I thought it was abandoned. Sorry. She looked around. Where does Stephen sleep?
My trailer, the man said. I have a few people who come by there when they need a place. Some peace and quiet. I've been letting people sleep in my trailer since 1981.
He paused. Fiona tried to take in this oddly specific fact, as if there was something about 1981 she should know. It didn't occur to her what he was waiting for until he said,
My name's Lionel Charters.
Oh, right. Sorry, she said. My name's Fiona. Fiona Sheridan. Lionel went still.
What is Malcolm Sheridan's other girl doing in my drive-in?
That made her meet his eyes. Malcolm Sheridan's other girl. I guess you were here when my sister died, she said. Lionel nodded and didn't look away.
My Uncle Chip started the drive-in in 1961, he said. When Chip died, I took it over. I ran it until 1997. Not many drive-ins lasted that long.
He shrugged.
It didn't bring in much money, especially toward the end, but I don't need much. My wife left in 80 and my son died in 81. Ever since then, it's been just me.
He seemed to be looking at her closely, but Fiona had lost her focus again, and things were slipping.
I was here that night. I was here every night. I was here when they found her, too. I could see all the commotion when I stood at the end of my drive and looked across Old Barron's Road, the ambulances and such. It was a shame what happened to your sister.
Fiona swallowed, unable to speak.
I've heard Stephen's story, Lionel said. He's wanted to talk to you for a long time. I take it he finally did.
Is it true? Fiona asked, her voice a croak. I'm not a good judge. Did he fool me?
Lionel was quiet for a moment, and then he shook his head.
Stephen didn't fool you, he said,
and the wariness in his voice was almost mixed with kindness.
What happened to Helen was real. If you're wondering if Tim Christopher did it, he did, just like he killed your sister. I'd swear that on my son's grave.
Why? She asked him. What makes you so certain? Lionel looked away. Something roared through Fiona. The restlessness she'd been feeling twisted hard in her gut, almost painful, and her blood jittered. She felt like screaming.
You saw something, she said softly, that night. You saw something.
I see a lot of things, Lionel said, his face hard. The ghost, for example. I see her.
He turned and looked at her.
Do you?
Fiona felt her face blanch.
She comes here?
Not here, Lionel said. This isn't her place. But over there,
he nodded in the direction of Old Barron's Road and Idlewild.
I've seen her walking plenty of times. Girl in a black dress and veil. The first time I saw her myself, it was 1983. I thought some teenager was playing a prank, dressing up, even though it wasn't close to Halloween. Who knows what teenagers find funny? So I went over there.
What did she show you? Fiona asked. Lionel blinked, his gaze going cold.
That's none of your business, just like it's none of my business what she showed you. What that girl does is cruel, a violation of everything that's good and right. I never believed in ghosts until that day, and even now I don't believe in them, except for that one. I believe in that one. And I've seen her walk the road and through the trees, but I've never gone back across Old Barron's Road again. What she showed me, I'll take to my grave.
Fiona's throat was raw. It felt like she'd swallowed razor blades. Still, she said to him, November 21st, 1994, what did you see? Lionel shook his head.
This isn't going to help you, girl. Just like what that abomination across the road shows you isn't going to help you. It's only going to cause pain. He's already in prison for what he's done.
She tried not to sway on her feet. Tell me. He sighed. A crow flew overhead, giving off its hoarse cry. A cold wind whistled through the bare trees past the old lot. The first dry flakes of snow landed on Fiona's coat.
The cops came that night, Lionel said, surprising her.
She'd never heard that before.
Said there was a complaint call, but I know I never made it.
He looked around.
It was November, and there were four kids here, maybe five, sitting in a circle, drinking God knows what. They'd made a little fire, but it didn't bother me. It wasn't big enough to spread, and I knew that eventually those kids would get cold and go home.
He raised his gaze to the dirt and gravel drive Fiona had driven up and lifted one hand from his rifle to motion to it briefly.
I was just telling the kids that no one had better puke in my bushes when Garrett Creel himself came walking up that path.
Fiona stared at him, shocked now. Garrett Creel?
In the flesh, Lionel said with contempt. That old fucker never liked me. Never liked that I'd go my own way. Living on my land, and I don't care about his rules. He'd come here plenty of times, asking if I'm growing weed out here or cooking meth or something, as if I'd do that shit after what happened to my boy. But that night was different.
He turned back to Fiona.
He came walking up the drive, you see, from the bottom, parked his cruiser down on Old Barron's Road and walked the rest of the way, instead of driving. Why'd he do that?
Fiona shook her head. She didn't know. None of this had ever been covered in the papers, in the trial. She felt like she was Alice in Wonderland.
So Creel comes up here, scares the shit out of the few drunk kids who were sitting here, gives them a lecture, something about lighting fires. Suddenly he's Smokey the fucking Bear. He turns to me, tells me I'm liable if anything happens, just the same as if I was sitting there drinking shitty brew with those kids. All bluster. He took his time. He
He thought I didn't notice, but I did. So when he walked away, going leisurely back down my drive, I cut across the hill over